Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
Clearly, actually producing a novel at the best of times can be a life-challenging experience. When you actually have passed, and really that looks as though that opportunity is gone, maybe say that novel that needed to be written has kind of also gone as well. No, absolutely not, because for the first time, featuring on Author of the Week, we will be focusing on the writing of an author who has indeed passed, an ace individual who's produced an epic tale called The School of the Haunted River. How can this be done, you may ask yourself? Well, we're delighted to welcome somebody who arguably could well be seen as the midwife to this particular novel and this particular adventure, and without whom, obviously, the world would just be a little bit more or less enjoyable for the whole system. We're actually delighted to actually welcome an editor and indeed a writer in residence who helped develop this text, Dee Hobsbawm-Smith, to the program. How are you, Dee?
Hi, Alex. Good morning. Well, it's good morning here. I'm great. Thank you.
It's always great to connect with, obviously, across the pond and so on. But I was fascinated by this tale of Colleen Going, who sadly, as they passed a little while ago now, and the School of the Haunted River. So would you like to just explain, first of all, how you got connected in the first place?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I live in Saskatchewan in central Canada, and in 2015-16, I was the writer in residence at the Saskatoon Public Library. Now, when you're in that kind of a role, you don't expect to see someone regularly, a few times maybe, but I saw Colleen Gerwing once a month for the entire duration of my term, which was about a year. And she was working on a writing project that she did not yet know quite what it was going to be, if it was going to be a novel, if it was going to be a creative nonfiction retelling of her own life or something in between. So we worked on it monthly. I keep wanting to say weekly, but we worked on it monthly, and she worked on it, I think, every day when she wasn't actually at her paying job. And we made progress, and we made progress and more progress, but she was a beginning writer. So it took a long time for her to figure out how to get on the page, what it was she wanted to say, and indeed, as I said, the form that it was going to take. So after the year and my term was up, we continued to meet on a monthly basis while she kept working on this, as you say, an epic piece of writing. You're right, novels can take years, and hers took her a few years. I heard back from her in 2019. So that was 3 years later.
Yeah. Now, obviously, Colleen herself had a fascinating history. She grew up on a family farm during near Lake Lenoir in Saskatchewan, a creative and adventurous child with a wonderful imagination. As I said at the start, it's rare that we actually use the notion of a eulogy to actually praise an author and so on. I mean, we possibly will do this when we actually look over somebody who's got a body of work and so on. But this is quite a unique element in terms of the way forward. As you said, writer in residence, building this connection from that. Is the analogy of you being a midwife to this product a useful one, or is it a case of, no, I did much more than that? I did the whole range of things. Or was it a case of, no, it's still Colleen's clear thoughts that are actually behind the School of the Haunted River?
Midwifing is a really good analogy for it. It is very much Colleen's work. And her partner, Marianne, after Colleen passed in 2019, having handed things over to me, with the request that I see it through to publication, which is rare, it's true, Marianne, her partner, said she didn't want to see Colleen's words taken in a direction other than where they were clearly headed, which mm-hmm. meant that there was a limited amount that I, as editor, could do. No substantive editing, really, no rearrangement of text, no shifting things around, no big deletions, just clean up the story so that Colleen's words are as clear and crystalline as she would have wanted them to be. So absolutely, I pushed it. She did all the hard pushing for sure. And I did fine-tuning only. It remains very much Colleen's story.
I was fascinated by the thoughts of Edward Willett, of course, editor and publisher of End the Sky Books, who had never met Colleen in real life, but felt that he'd gotten to know her through reading her novel. And surely no novelist, no writer can have any greater accolade than that, because it really does lend that whole notion of the writer as an immortal voice crossing the generations, spanning the bridge of time, and spanning, as I say, that experience, obviously, which comes to us all, let's face it, death and taxes. From that point of view, you know, it is there. I mean, was that something, again, you were conscious of in terms of the responsibility, really, of maintaining that link?
Well, entirely. Colleen's story, as I said, the only thing that I can think of, well, one of the few other things that a novelist would view as a high accolade, other than their life being continued on the page, would be for someone to say to them, I stayed up all night to finish that book. I couldn't put it down. And I'm hoping that's going to be the experience that readers will have when they start delving into the story that Colleen has recounted on the page. Mm-hmm. That is a weaving, truly, a weaving of her own life into novel form, which gives, you know, gives the novelist a whole lot more leeway in terms of what they can do and how to express it, and frees up the writer from the worries of, not that there was any risk of it in this story, but the worries of if there's anyone in a creative nonfiction story that doesn't want to be included on the page. Didn't happen here. That wasn't the case. But certainly the long form novel is a great way to explore things. I know that there are people who think that creative nonfiction is the only way to explore a writer's inner life. But, you know, I'm a poet, and I write nonfiction, and I write novels, and Colleen's novel is as clear an indicator of her inner and external life being merged as you could hope for.
The School of the Haunted River is, as we've said, a semi-autobiographical tale. It's relates the adventures of an aunt and her niece, Jay and Dilly, on a midwinter snowshoe trek in northern Saskatchewan. I mean, I'm of the generation, you might well say, whoa, this is a way back, where you sort of think about the outdoorsman as being writers like Jack London and so on, and areas within that. Just share with us a kind of flavour of the School of the Haunted River and how this the character of Jay effectively really recounts her experiences in an outdoor education as we said, this epic narrative.
Welcome to Canada. The truth about Canada is that we mostly live in a very narrow band along the border with the United States. And there are huge tracts in the north stretching away that are sparsely populated. First Nations populations, absolutely. And some of those areas have become home to national parks, and some have not. Saskatchewan, people tend to think in particular of Saskatchewan as being the breadbasket of Canada, and that it's all wheat fields and happy cows and things like that, very, very farm-like and pastoral, when in actual fact, it's as rugged a landscape as you'd want to find. Beyond the farms, beyond the ranches, there are sand dunes, and there are river valleys and coulees, and there is certainly extreme weather. And in the north, in the boreal forest and north, there are lakes. And it's a lake system that is actually an extended river system, but they present as small lakes attached one to the other through small rivers with portages, lots and lots of rapids, really tough landscape, compounded in the wintertime by cold, of course, in the summer by heat and bugs, bad bugs, lots of bugs, more bugs than you want to think about. So going on an expedition in the wintertime means not only are you face to face with having to know your way around and be conversant with the tools of navigation, which at the time that this was set back in the 2000s, early 2000s, and a deliberate choice on the part of the narrator, Jay, no extreme navigation, no GPS to actually help them find their way from follow one lake connecting river to the next. So there they are out in the middle of bush and flat and small hills, trying to find their way. And the narrator is guided by of her own journey that she had made as a younger woman in her early 20s, as a solo canoeist to complete a schooling, an outdoor schooling project that she had undertaken that began in Wyoming. So as a younger woman, she had been dropped in the middle of northern Saskatchewan with her canoe and a paddle and told that she would meet up with this enigmatic packing character named Cowboy, who would supply her with food at regular intervals. So it's never as easy as it sounds, right? There she is out in the middle of nowhere, and still quite a neophyte, because it's her first on her own kind of trip out on in this kind of a landscape, and certainly on her own, you really have to learn to rely on yourself. So as the older Jay is out in the wintertime with her niece Dilly, who is named incidentally after Annie Dillard, the great American naturalist and writer, as she's out on this wintertime trip, trying to help her niece gain a love of the natural world and build a bond with it that would sustain her through a life spent living in the city, Jay is remembering her own trip as a young woman of about the same age during the summertime paddling. And she arrived on her younger trip on what isn't quite spring in northern Saskatchewan, i.e. there with the canoe. And she gets there, and lo and behold, she can't put the canoe in the water because the water is still ice. So that's a difficult beginning to a young woman's travel. And so she builds all these layers of her own life. This is Colleen I'm speaking of. Colleen's own life as a naturalist and a longtime employee in the national park system here in Canada, with her own experiences on this trip and on many others, into this narrative of reverence, really, reverence for the natural world, and an awareness of the major role that the natural world plays in our lives, even for those of us who live urban lives and we are not very connected with the natural world. It's still out there, and it still has a big impact, as anyone paying attention to the issues of climate change is very well aware.
It's become almost a cliche when giving advice to budding writers and so on. The phrase, write what you know, often is used frequently. And the notion that actually lived experience is the best basis for writing, even if arguably you're using those lived experiences in a fantasy way or a different form, etc. I mean, this surely was the grade A example of somebody writing about what they know, because you already mentioned this is somebody who did take a solo canoe trip. This is somebody who lived in the outdoors, that actually had that notion of the stewardship of the planet, the areas relating to that. Was that something which, in a sense, you thought, well, this is a gift in so many ways, you know, in terms of formulating the thoughts of Colleen? And again, you know, looking to that, I also see the cinematic possibilities that are there as well. Was that something which, in a sense, you kind of felt not just, I hesitate to use the term proud about, but I think you maybe actually sort of really enjoyed the process? I mean, was it a fun experience? You know, when this writer comes up to you as your writer of residence and comes up with this, you know, this initial idea, I mean, there's an initial tendency presumably to say, yeah, okay, fine, let's see how it goes. But did you kind of find the magic of that creation working as the narrative was being developed and produced?
Yes. The short answer is yes. The longer answer is that, of course, Alex, it was much more complicated than that, because this was the first thing that Colleen had written. And, you know, it's like trying to do double axels before you can really skate. As one of my mentors told me a long time ago, you have to get the skills and learn how to build sentences that are going to hold a reader's interest and sentences that will allow the story to emerge. You know, so understanding how to use language, well, Colleen had that. She always had that. She was clear about how much she loved language. But first, she did have to sort out and unpack all of these different experiences of her own. And the original story was more of a fable. It really began as a fable. So when she came back to me after we'd spent the year at the library and the year following, then there was a two-year gap where she was working with other Canadian writers, Trevor Harriet, the Saskatchewan naturalist among them, and J. Jill Robinson for another. When she came back to me, what she had in her hand was an early draft of what she had clearly decided was going to be a novel. So she had, during those years, and that's what it takes, during those years, she had come to an understanding of how a novel could serve her best, but she never lost sight of what the underlying story was always going to be. She always had that right from the get-go. She knew what she wanted this to do. She just didn't know how to do it yet. So she learned over many years, she learned how to get that story on the page. So, you know, it's the journey of every writer, you know, how to say, oh my God, I got all this stuff in my brain. How do I get that on the page? That's the writer's journey, is to start to become a master and mistress of craft, so that all those images that are doing cartwheels in our heads end up coherently, and when you need, they need to be completely incoherently on the page. So that's the life of a writer.
You raise a very important point there, Dee, which is the craft of the writer. I mean, in an era that, I mean, you mentioned obviously this novel was written before the advent of GPS technology, the aspects relating to that. Equally, the novel's been produced in an era where people might say, well, could you not have just used artificial intelligence to actually produce a chat GPT and actually put all of those things together and produce the sort of material from that? I think the current answer, thankfully, is probably no. But that whole notion of the craft of writing and revisiting the draft and reconnecting with that whole aspect. Did you ever get the sense that, you know, Colleen, obviously post-publication, and I'm thinking about that notion that we are spiritual beings on a human journey, etc. Did you get a sense that there was still, you know, that not only her imprint was present within the actual text itself, but there was a notion of, yeah, there's a quiet satisfaction that even though, you know, arguably taken from us far too soon, I think 58 when she passed, but in terms of the actual legacy that's actually there, yeah, those words are still going to be there and are going to be there as the 21st century becomes the 22nd century.
I believe in the ongoing existence of our lives in spirit form. Yes, absolutely. And I think that she is so imbued in these words that even if I didn't believe that she is still present in the natural world, which I do, I think that she has definitely created something where who and what she believed are here for the next reader, for the next generation. Mm-hmm. So short answer is yes, she's here with us. And it's a real tribute to perseverance in the face of illness. I think mm-hmm. that she got this novel to the shape that it was in before she passed it over to me in 2019 and passed herself, you know, just a couple of weeks later. You know, she said, Dee, I think I've left this too long. And I'm going, oh my God. And then I found out that 2 weeks later that she'd passed.
I was just going to say seven words that actually sum up the epitaph, really. She left the world a better place, yes. Which I think is probably the dream of most human beings in some way, shape or form. We've talked about her writing. If you actually look at the cover, of course, of The School of the Haunted River, it's a pretty impressive cover art drawing as well. I mean, you know, she's a painter as well. Was that something which, again, you were surprised at? Because sometimes you don't have a skill set that transfers. I mean, good novelists don't necessarily make good painters or illustrators.
Yeah, I'm a good case in point. I'm a terrible painter. I did know that Colleen was a painter because she had given me a small river rock that she had painted a little landscape on back in 2016 at the conclusion of my time at the library. So I knew she was a painter, but I had not been in her home. So I thought, oh, that's a beautiful little river rock. That's nice. And then when I met her partner, Marianne, and she was walking me around her apartment, and she said, Colleen painted that, and she painted that, and that's hers too, and that's hers too. And this one is the one that I think should be the cover of her novel, at which point my jaw dropped about a foot and a half, because it's a stunning photograph. It puts me definitely a little in mind of the seven. I want to say the Magnificent Seven, the School of Seven, seven Canadian painters, group of seven, there it is. It's quite Group of Seven, but that could entirely be the fact that it's set out in the natural world and in the North Country, where a lot of the Group of Seven liked to paint, even though they were mostly farther east in Ontario. So a painter, yeah, it was a big part of her life, according to her partner, Marianne, and something that she was a painter for many years, as you must be to, you know, get to the point where you can recreate. It's a realist image of her view of herself, and it makes the perfect cover, because there is this solo person, gender unclear, in a canoe on their own, looking at this gorgeous vista of trees and a curving little river with rocks facing it and light coming down from the sky and these beautiful clouds. So she's looking upstream, what comes next, which is something that she always said, according to Marianne, let's just see what's around the next bend. Right. So there it is, right on the cover. So I love it. I think it's a fabulous, fabulous tribute to who she was as a human and what she put on the page as well.
Well, the metaphor, of course, of the river is something that's been frequently used, even arguably since the mythologies of the River Styx and the crossing into the souls of the dead, right the way through to River of Dreams and Billy Joel, and indeed just around the River Bend from Pocahontas. So that notion of constantly moving, I mean, I'm struck by the phrase, we are all born of a river, and that in itself should be enough. That's a really powerful metaphor for the life journey and life experience. Is that also something which, again, emerges from this particular text? And although you did an expert job in actually describing the whole thing there, very consciously that you're aware that this is a radio interview as opposed to a visual thing, I'd say to anybody to actually check out that river painting, check out the book, obviously online. But that whole notion of the river as a metaphor for our experience in this short while we exist for, I don't know, however many years we're granted on the planet, was that something which again also connects with the notion of really the book, not only as an autobiographical piece, but also as a philosophical piece as well?
Well, you're right. The river and water have been metaphors in a lot of very powerful writing. So I'm not a water baby. I'm not comfortable in boats. They make me feel like, oh my God, everything's wiggling here. But it was an amazing thing to read about someone who lived in a canoe and in the water as comfortably as she did on land. So all of the tribulations that we face, you know, all those rapids and all those waterfalls and all those huge Niagaras that happen in everyone's life, you know, it's true that we start out, I'm thinking right now, the Bow River that starts up in Alberta, way up at Bow Glacier, and goes over Bow Falls in Banff and ends up being one of the main rivers that goes past the city of Calgary, where I lived for a long time. And then it joins the same water system heading north that the Saskatchewan flows into, that and those are all the rivers that feed those northern little lakes, lake-like water tributaries. And out there where it's flat and they turn into these sort of large, looking big enough to be a lake, stretches of water, you know, I think about how in our lives we certainly come across times where we look across the landscape of our life and all we can see is either smooth sailing, smooth water, but where everything looks the same. Is this where I've always been? Am I going to get through this? And conversely, we come to those waterfalls and go, I can't do this. I simply can't do this. I don't have the skills. And of course, you know, most of the time we learn as we go through. We learn. That's how we learn how to do life. Same way as Colleen learned how to become a better paddler and a better climber and a better survivor out in the natural world, was learning by doing. That's life.
The interpretation officer for Prince Albert National Park, Lauren Markovitz, quoted as saying, Colleen always sought to connect or reconnect others with nature. Her thoughtful words continue to impact all those who knew her or read her writing. Let's talk a little bit about Dee Hobsbawm Smith, because we talked, obviously, and quite rightly so, about Colleen and the line from that point of view. Writer in residence, of course, editor from that perspective. What, again, from your own perspective, what advice would you give somebody who might be listening to this piece who thinks, you know, I've got a novel within me that I need to write. And it doesn't necessarily be about reconnecting with nature. It can be literally a case about, I don't know, maybe living their life in Lincoln, England, or experiencing life as an agricultural soul, or whatever experience they happen to be. What would you say? Would you say do it, or say just think about it? Think about the long, hard challenges you're faced with.
Do it. Do it. People who are driven to write are driven to write for specific reasons. Those reasons vary, but I know that for me, if I wasn't a writer, I would not be able to think my way through what I think and feel about issues and people and places and the world that we live in and life in general. So as a writer, on the practical side, start by telling the story. Even if you don't know where you want to begin, you'll find the beginning after you get the story done. Just jump in and start telling the story. What's going to be the saving grace for any writer, especially a novelist and a poet and a writer, all types of writers, the saving grace is revision. That's where every writer has the chance to rethink what they put on the page, make it clearer, make it better, reorganize it, up the amperage of the words so that, excuse my phone, up the amperage of the words so that they don't read like cliches and they don't read like yesterday's news and they don't read like old language. It's revision that is at the heart of making that story come alive. So even a beginning writer, as Colleen was, a beginning writer just has to get it down on the page. The other things that are important to a writer at any caliber is, one is reading better writers. Always great to read better writers. How did other writers tell this kind of a story? How did other writers make their points? How did other writers create dialogue that felt real? Create characters who would keep you up at night to find out what happened to them. It's reading other writers that I think is one of the gold mines of becoming a writer, because, oh my God, you know, reading, which is, I think, I'm afraid to admit this out loud, I think reading is declining with the digital age, but immersing yourself in a book is one of the great pleasures, way better than watching a movie, one of the great pleasures that keep you up at night. So as a writer, as an editor, once you get the story done, put it away, let it rest. Time really is the best editor you could ever hope for. So put it away and let it rest. Come back to it when the emotional charge is gone. And that could take some time, right? That could take some time. That could be a month. It could be 2 months. It could be a year, depending on how hot the topic was. Come back when the charge is gone and reread it. And then take another run at it and start revising. There will come a point where, as a writer, you'll think, oh my God, I'm done, I'm done. Then at that point, you bring in someone else and you show it to a sharper, different pair of eyes. And then you start again.
We mentioned that The School of the Haunted River is a much better read than actually checking out the latest TikTok video. And I think you'd be right in terms of that. But in terms of the sequence, are there any plans for any other cross-media or transmedia developments, things like audiobooks, things like the notion of, who knows, possibly to say that motion picture option as well. Is that something which you're thinking about, or is it a case of, no, I've done my bit now, it's over to Colleen's estates to actually deal with further developments?
Those are really good questions, Alex. It's a really visual book, and I think that it would lend itself to a gorgeous, beautiful, slow-moving movie. I have thought that from the moment where it became clear that it was a novel and that Colleen had figured out what the story was. I'm hoping an audio book will be in the works. I'll be just discussing that with Edward and with Marianne, Colleen's partner. So I'm hoping those will both come into, who knows about, you know, writing treatments for movies. I don't know anything about that, but I do know that there are some books that you read and go, oh, Really visual, look good on the screen. So we're hopeful. We haven't begun discussions yet because it's just arriving in bookstores now in hard copy, but I'm hoping that something will emerge next.
And just looking back to some of Colleen's biography there, 1977, she attended the National Outdoor Leadership School in Wyoming, worked as a guide at Algonquin Park, and in the 1970s also had a small company called Wilderness Trips for Women. I mean, it's particularly interesting, I think, from that perspective, that people often forget that Yeah, feminism hasn't just arrived in the last few years of cancel culture and hashtag Me Too. It has a long history of areas with respect to that and working through the process, like canoeing, cross-country skiing, horseback riding, winter camping. I'm just amazed that when it was the winter, you think, okay, you take some time to relax, but no, she studied French in Quebec, German in Germany, Cree in Saskatoon, etc. I mean, this is a pretty darn good description of what you could arguably say is a Renaissance woman, really, at work.
I would think of her as that, definitely, a painter and someone who's interested in language as a way to communicate not only with the First Nations people who in a lot of Canada and the United States. I think it was a real sign of not just respect, but of a recognition that the world is bigger than the job that we hold. Although in Colleen's case, she was one of the rare ones who I think really, really loved what she did for her living. And that means that she was really doubly blessed, I think.
The book, once again, a reminder, it's entitled The
School of the
School
Haunted
of the
River.
Haunted River. Exactly. That's all right. We're just the School of the Haunted River. I was having one of those moments where I thought, I'm still thinking back to your notion of the Magnificent Seven. I thought it would have been quite interesting to see how the Seven Samurai and Akira Kurosawa could have actually sort of been developed as painters, but that's another line entirely. Canadian painters are there.
Oh, that's another interesting thought.
Absolutely. But it is available now. You can obviously access it through a whole range of things. You can find out all the information, of course, by going to endless sky-books.com. Dee, it's been awesome sharing some thoughts with the good self. And hopefully, Colleen going, if she's there in the spirit sense, we'll hopefully be really be ha happy with respect to that. But I'll ask you the last two questions because we can't really ask Colleen these. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the Author of the Week feature today? Has it been good for you?
This has been a terrific opportunity to talk about Colleen and help people become aware of her book. So thank you very much for your generosity and for your time and your really good questions.
Well, the next question, of course, is the final one. Dee, will you be kind enough to return and talk about some of your own work and indeed advice for writers and so on? Will you come back?
Absolutely. Yes. So just let me know how I can be in touch with you other than hitting that Zoom Connect button, Alex.
Fuck them. One thing you gotta learn is not to be afraid of it. I said, no, I like it. I like it, it's good. She said, you like it now, but you'll learn to love it later.
Now, clearly, the old line about there being only two certainties in life, i.e. death and taxes, is still very much present in the 21st century. But when we actually do go, what's the preferred way of actually going? Clearly, some people prefer to be buried 6 feet under. Some people prefer to simply say, OK, we'll be cremated. But what about water cremation or resummation? Arguably the biggest change to funerals in more than 120 years is actually coming about now. Well, we're delighted to feature two fine folk who'll be able to talk about this particular aspect, which was indeed chosen by Archbishop Desmond Tutu for his funeral arrangements back in 2021. The two souls that we're delighted to speak to today are Director of Resummation Service at Kindly Earth. That's Julian Atkinson. How are you, Julian?
Hello, Bert. Yeah, very well, thank you.
And from the Department of Theology and Religion at Durham University, we've got Professor Douglas Davis. How are you, Douglas?
I'm very well, thanks, and good to be here.
Well, likewise. Now, Douglas, this particular process, I can already hear people saying, oh, I don't know about that. What is all about? How can we be cremated with water? Surely the water will put out the flames, etc. What were your initial thoughts when the whole process effectively emerged? And obviously with Desmond Tutu, obviously electing to have his funeral service conducted in this manner.
My thoughts were with how inventive the British are when it comes to death, because late in the 19th century, cremation came on the cards, though it took, nearly 50 years before even 1% of the British public got round to being cremated. But then things really speeded up as the 20th century went on, so that by the time we got to the 1960s, more than half of the British public was being cremated. So it was that issue of invention and of how people move ahead and sometimes wait for the law to catch up with current practice. Then I was very interested in the 1990s and did considerable amount of research on what was then called green woodland or eco burial. And that again was quite a change. And now we have hundreds of green burial sites across the country. So when I heard some years ago now of a resummation or whatever particular name we want to give to alkaline hydrolysis, it seemed to me, yes, here are the British rethinking the whole issue of death in relation to their environment and with the background fact that the British are great engineers, because without the engineering of the Industrial Revolution, we wouldn't have had cremation. And in a sense, without precision engineering going into the equipment lying behind resummation, we wouldn't have that other either. So I saw those things as running together. And I don't think actually that the funeral trade, in terms of the minds of people, is necessarily conservative. I think the Brits are often quite used to thinking, yes, I'll fit it in with how I live. And maybe the ecological, environmental attitude with its values is part of how the British think and feel.
Julian, the notion of us being food for worms, as put forward in Dead Poets Society a good few years ago, is something which is at the heart of, obviously, the cyclical nature of life and so on. Now, first, they see that some evidence suggests that this resummation process could be more sustainable than gas cremation, with almost a third of UK adults actually choosing alternative committal methods if available. So presumably, from your own point of view, this is something you'd very much like to sing the praises of.
Yeah, I've always had a keen eye on the environment. And when I came across this technology, I looked at it very carefully to see how it compared to other forms of disposition. And that was obviously cremation, because there simply isn't any other anything else which is on the market at the moment. You know, this is offered in America and in Canada and in South Africa. So we had good data to work with. And looking at that data using life cycle assessments, we were able to study what's available here, as in the cremation, and compare it with what resumation was showing us. And it showed there was and could be a significant upside to resumation, not just because it uses water and it's a more gentle process, but because it uses less fossil fuel in the process. And the fossil fuel, as we know, is climate changing, and I think that we all have to change our ways to meet the carbon objectives and to reduce climate warming. So yes, from that point of view, it definitely appealed, and it's felt something I wanted to get involved in bringing it to the UK and making it available for families to choose from when they come to arrange a funeral.
So breaking it down into its practicalities, the deceased is enclosed in a biodegradable pouch, placed in a container filled with pressurized water, a small amount of potassium hydroxide, that's KOH if you're a chemist. Each cycle obviously takes approximately 4 hours. At the end of that cycle, the soft bones which are left are dried, then reduced to white powder, which is similar to ash, and the remains then returned to relatives in a sustainable urn. So presumably there's still the opportunity for people, should they wish, to obviously take the deceased ashes and scatter them on the favourite football ground or location they prefer to actually have their ashes scattered.
Yes, it's fair to say the funeral people can choose what they want. They can have any type of funeral they want. That might be contemporary, might be traditional, may go to a church, may go to another point of gathering, say their goodbyes. The resumation takes place with the deceased in our care. We return the ashes in a sustainable urn to the family. And then the family, there's different customs. You know, some people like a favourite walk, a favourite place, favourite holiday destination, in the garden, planting trees. You know, there's a lot of variations we hear about. And some people go for more exotic, like want to be dropped from the sky, from a plane and things like this. But in the main, people like to keep the ashes at home, scatter the ashes, or bury the ashes, usually in a family burial plot.
Douglas, is this a preferred choice for yourself, or are you more of a traditionalist?
Well, at the moment, I'm a scholar, because my great task in life has been to study, early on, the reuse of old graves, cremation, woodland burial, and now this. So my ideas tend to change as my knowledge shifts. So what I think today might be quite different tomorrow. So I prefer to keep my thoughts to myself.
I was going to say, you're clearly keeping your options open there, Douglas. Don't worry, we won't press you. Julian, same question for yourself. Have you said, yes, this is definitely the way I'll be going?
Well, I have thought about a funeral wishes, which is hardly surprising. And, you know, given all the upside and being honest with Desmond Tutu leading the way, I really feel I have no problem in saying tick the box for resumation for me.
There you go. And where can people find out further details about resumation and indeed your package with respect to Kindly Earth?
For me, Kindly Earth, it's a simple website address, Kindly Earth. And for finding out about funerals and how resumation can be offered, I suggest going onto the co-op website and just type in resumation on the search bar, and you should get some helpful advice from there on.
Julian Atkinson, Director of Resumation Service for Kindly Earth, and Professor Douglas Davis from the Department of Theology and Religion at Durham University. Many thanks indeed, and let's hope that it's many, many years before you actually need to think seriously about those particular areas. Who knows, by that time you might be downloading your consciousness into an artificial form, an intelligence that actually works as an android that grants a form of immortality, which could be another theological question, I'm sure, Douglas.
I'm sure it could.
That's very kind of you. Thank you, Alex.
Retirement is something which many of us will think about at some stage in our lives, probably as we enter our fifth decade or sixth decade, etc., maybe even earlier. It really depends how long you have been saving for. It's extraordinary to find that Phoenix Insight have actually come up with the top five regions with the most savings. And the east of England comes in at second place, really, just ahead of the southeast, Scotland and Northern Ireland. Greater London apparently is number one there. But to actually talk us through some of the details with respect to this and why actually you need to think very seriously about your pension pots if you want to ensure that your lifestyle is maintained or indeed enhanced during retirement, we're delighted to welcome the Head of Research Analysis and Policy at Phoenix Insight. That's Patrick Thompson. How are you, Patrick?
Very well, thank you. Glad to be here.
Excellent. Now, in terms of this particular finding, any real surprises, or is it a case of, well, we know that people aren't really saving as much as they should be. They should be putting in more. We could be talking about, obviously, the notion of lifelong learning, lifelong working actually taking place. So we know that unlike France, where there's almost a revolution, where they actually dare to raise the retirement age up to 64, here we're 67, probably heading 68, 69, 70, and so on. So how important is it that people start thinking about, obviously, what they're going to be doing with respect to their pensions?
We think it's really important. So about one in three people born today will live to 100. And we've seen more and more people living longer lives. And that should be giving us more opportunities for our careers and spending time with friends and family and enjoying retirement. But how we're working and how much we're able to save, it's not always keeping up with those changes. So we've got new research out today, and that's surveyed 2,500 people over the age of 45. So people coming up to retirement in probably the coming decades and who are still in work. And we've looked at it right across the country. And there are some really interesting and sometimes worrying figures. So a quarter of people say they definitely won't have enough money to live on when they retire. And we've known for some time there are these big saving gaps right across the UK. But what this new data shows is that how it's been felt across the country. So there are big regional differences. So some parts of the country are saving 40% more in their retirement pots than others. We also know that about one in four workers don't know what type of pensions they have. And 10% of workers don't have any retirement savings at all. So it is a very mixed picture, but we think by having more people having a conversation, thinking about their longer lives, what it means for their savings, for the way they work, all these other things can be a really valuable thing.
Now, clearly, we can't all be Mick Jagger or indeed Joan Collins, who obviously have got their own particular fortunes that they've established from that point of view. But you know, life changes can occur in all sorts of ways, etc. People could actually lose partners, gain partners, and so on and so forth. Thinking ahead is always a little bit of a hostage to fortune. Is it just a case of basically save regularly and save often?
That's a pretty good starting point, yeah. So the earlier you can do it, the better it is, obviously, because those savings, they'll compound, they'll grow a bit more as you go through life as well. So yes, really starting earlier is one key thing. And like you say, there is a lot of uncertainty about the future, but the more you can save, that gives you more options for the future. And it's not just about your retirement savings. That's a really key part of it as well. But it's also about the type of work you're in and the type of job you want to do in the future as well. We know a lot of jobs are more difficult to do as you age. So actually, if you think about upskilling, perhaps moving jobs as you go through life, actually that can have really good outcomes. It makes you happier in your working life, but also can really help you save more for the future as well.
That was something I was interested in terms of the actual quantitative data that you produced, because does it actually account for people who actually move to different parts of the country? So you might start off, for instance, in the east of England, go down and spend a few years working in London, then move up to Scotland, etc. Or is it just a case of where you take a snapshot at a particular time of the year?
This one is a snapshot of where people are living right now. But you're right, people move around, they move around the country. They also do move jobs as well. So it's really important to recognize the fact that people aren't just static. They don't stay in the same place. They're constantly changing and moving. And that's why things like support for people to save for their retirement, that needs to change as well and be adaptive. We think, for instance, that if we had better access to more independent financial advice and more people could access those things, that would really help people on their retirement planning journey as well. But also if we had things like, you know, better and more consistent careers advice as well, and for people of all ages, that could really help people think about the type of job they want to be and then perhaps how much they need to save for the future as well.
Would you recommend actually ensuring that people actually have their own personal accountants to check that all things are working through that, or basically just go to an organization like Phoenix Insight?
I think it's up to the individual to decide themselves, but the main thing is to have a think of that question for yourself and see if that's the right thing for you. If people are interested in how they compare to other parts of the country as well, we've got a free interactive map that people can look at themselves. If you look up Phoenix Group and Longer Lives, there's this interactive map, and you can see how your part of the country compares to any other part as well. And we hope that kind of prompts some thoughts and discussion. And actually, if you have this conversation with someone around you as well, think of a friend, a family member, a colleague, perhaps think about how they're getting on. And actually, many people are going through the same thing as you and perhaps have some good advice as well.
Politically, we hear a great deal about the triple lock, obviously, with both Conservative and Labour saying they've got to maintain the triple lock. They've got to keep that pension line in tune with inflation, etc. It's not really necessarily the best thing to rely on what politicians say. I'm just being speculative about this. Would you actually say that, again, you need to ultimately take control of your finances as far as possible and ensure that your own savings aren't just reliant on the government or the state pensions?
We've been looking a lot at the state pension recently because we're coming up to the 75th anniversary of it. So that's coming up just this week. And we've done some research on it. And people absolutely fundamentally think it is a key part of the social security system, but also their retirement savings in the future. What we found by looking to people, though, is that can offer people the basics. And as long as you make sure you get in your national insurance contributions, you get your access to your full state pension when you reach that age. But we found very much that people thought of that as being the basic level. But to have a comfortable and a good retirement with more options as well for your longer life, you do need to save into a private pension or a workplace pension as well, alongside of savings and other things as well. So it's part of a rounded picture. But our research also looked at how much people thought they'd be relying on the state pension. And actually, it was a fair few people would be relying just on the state pension when they retire.
Yeah, which could be quite worrying, of course. Finally, can you just remind us of the Phoenix Insight web address and where you'd point people to find out more details about the research?
Absolutely. If you go to Phoenix Group and look up Longer Lives as well, that will show the full interactive data map.
Patrick Thompson, Head of Research Analysis and Policy at Phoenix Insight. Huge thanks and keep on keeping on.
Thank you very much.
Style someday, old dream.